From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, investigative reporter Cheryl Jones joins us with some amazing stories, followed by conversations with Cheryl, your phone calls. Here's what's happening. Japan's broadcaster NHK reported a missile launch from North Korea, stating the projectile was estimated to have fallen some 2,000 kilometers off its coast. The news, however, was retracted shortly thereafter. It was a mistake, an erroneous report. Everybody's on edge. China, Russia, and Iran will hold joint naval drills starting Friday in the Gulf of Oman. Beijing and Tehran said this at the time of a heightened tension between the United States because of us withdrawing its landmark nuke deal with Iran. Dr. Jerome Corsi, author of the Horowitz Report, which we'll tell you about in just a moment, is with us. Jerry, this exercise with Russia, China, and Iran, I don't like that.
Well, George, it's certainly an escalation of tensions in the region. I mean, this is the first time we've had Russia and China and Iran working on exercises together. And it's a new level of tension, especially with the Israeli elections going on right now. The entire region, I think, is like a tinderbox at the moment.
Yeah, well, it does. And this situation with North Korea, did they launch, did they not? How could Japan make a mistake like that?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, the entire Japanese nation was on edge on that report, and it was false. But just shows again, George, how tense all the situations are right now, and how on edge I think people are about what could happen both with North Korea and with Iran at any moment.
Hey, Jerry, tell us about the new book, The Horowitz Report.
Well, George, I published the entire unabridged Horowitz Report with a new foreword I've written. I think the initial reports that it was, you know, no political bias was belied if you read the report. It looks to me like there's going to be indictments coming down with this Durham investigation. Certainly, we also published in the book the rebuttals by Attorney General Barr and by the U.S. Attorney Durham, which really suggests that this is a much, much more serious problem. It's not going to be, there was political bias, and I think there were crimes committed in the application of getting a FISA court approval to do electronic surveillance over Carter Page on the basis of the Steele dossier, which I think was not verified. It's a very serious report, and I think people need to read it in detail.
And precisely, who is Michael Horowitz?
Michael Horowitz was the Inspector General of the Department of Justice who just did this report on the FISA court, which is the court that looks over electronic surveillance, has to approve it on any U.S. citizen. And I think the court was really misled by the Department of Justice, which used the Steele dossier as the basis for getting the approval to do electronic surveillance on Carter Page. And the report, I think, lists abuses which are going to end up in criminal indictments coming down the pike.
All right. Track that story for us, Jerry, and we'll check in with you at a later date. Thank you. UPS expects return packages to hit a record high following this year's holiday shopping season as consumers shop more online, so they're expecting volumes of returns. And if you're worried about packing on pounds this holiday season, researchers suggest drinking some coffee could help. A new study finds that drinking 4 cups of coffee a day could reduce weight gain from a diet high in fat and sugar. How about that? Up in the skies, it's Peter Davenport searching for UFOs from the National UFO Reporting Center. How are reports this week other than Santa, Peter?
Good evening. No Santa reports, George, but plenty of others, and I'm going to have to rely on that coffee solution to my weight problem. Trim down a bit. I've overdone it at my cousin Doug's here in Albany, Oregon. But I've been away from the center for 4 days, but I've succeeded in putting together a little report that I think people will enjoy. First report comes from the 11th of November, a Veterans Day, of course, Monday of last month. a gentleman reports, actually two adults report, they saw a, in Bethel, Alaska, they saw a very, what they perceived to be a very large, dark object in the morning sky over Bethel. And the interesting thing about this report is they could hear a sound coming from it. Clearly, it was not, they write, it was not a conventional aircraft. And very intriguing report. Something similar several days later, actually several weeks later. This is from Monday of this week, the 23rd of December. Petersfield, Manitoba, very close to the famous Gimli, where the Gimli glider event took place, where they landed a 767 without power. Gentleman reports he saw a dark object, dark or black object, come down out of the clear blue sky and stop and hover in the daytime sky, suddenly turn to a ring of light and just disappeared in the flash of a bat of an eye. Another couple of reports are very similar, George. These have me baffled, and I don't know what I'm dealing with here, but one from Davenport, Florida. I couldn't resist the temptation.
I love it.
The other one from Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. People report essentially the same thing. They were out at night, and the night sky started strobing. In the case of Florida, it strobed from orange to red to yellow. And in the case of Mount Pleasant, it strobed from blue to red to green. Ordinarily, in those circumstances, I would be suspicious of a rocket launch out of Cape Canaveral. But these two sightings were an hour and a half apart. I have no idea what caused them. On the 19th of December this month, a gentleman who lives in Jerome, Idaho, reported that he saw two very distinctly, very bright yellow lights moving across the sky. They were below solid overcast, and did I forget to say this gentleman is a 10,000-hour sort of commercial pilot and flight instructor, and he said he's never seen anything like it, George. Something similar from Lipan, Texas, the same day, same night, and have no idea what these people are seeing. But with that, I'll draw my report to a close and save the other reports for next week.
All right, my friend Peter, I'm glad you had a great Christmas and talk to you soon. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. How does 2020 look? We're going to glance into the future with George Uhrer in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with George Uhrer. Let me tell you a little bit about George, business consultant, financial writer. He has been a senior vice president of an international airline, a vocational school president, had a two-year sales and marketing assignment for a major software company as well. He has a master's in business, publishes the urbansurvival.com website, as well as the peoplenomics.com site. And George, welcome back. Looking forward to this chat with you tonight.
George, it's always great talking with you.
Boy, the old market is finished with a bang.
It did. That is both a good thing and a bad thing.
Uh-oh.
Because we've been here before. Let's look at a couple of numbers.
First, all right.
I track things using what I call the aggregate index. Now, the aggregate index assumes that at some point back, say, January 1st of 2000, when techs were still on their way up, that you'd taken $100 into the Dow, $100 into the NASDAQ, and $100 into the S&P 500. And then what you do is you track the progress of those that pile of money going forward. And that gets to be interesting because where the stock market became difficult for people to make sense of was when the techs collapsed and the financial industry just simply stopped talking about them. In other words, if you don't talk about it, never happened. So, sure, you can lose $5 trillion in market valuation during the tech wreck, but if you don't talk about the techs and you talk about the great strength of everything else, people tend to wash over it. So it's not the first time we've been here. We've seen bubbles arise in the past. 1929 is the big one, and on the urbansurvival.com website, I put up a chart just a few minutes ago, and it asks the question, will 2020 be when we replay 1929?
Uh-huh. Let's hope not.
This year, George, from the, I call it the slaughter of the elves last year, the stock market dropped about 15% from the beginning of December to the market lows around Christmas. But since then, we have come screaming back, and the aggregate from last Christmas to now is up 38%. And you saw, of course, the NASDAQ composite closed above 9,000 today.
Which, yeah, huge.
Huge, huge deal. And I wish I could tell you I was up 38% for the year, but I'm good at analytics, but I tend to trade too far ahead of the market. And that's something that I think everyone's got a problem with. The market moves slower than smart people think and faster than dumb people think. And so when you're plotting out your financial future for 2020, you have to sit back and say, okay, the market will have these couple of hundred point down days, and it'll have the couple of hundred point up days. But the simplest way I've found to keep track of that stuff is to just watch it as a trend channel and try and figure out the overall direction of the market, be on that side of the market, and that should do okay for you in 2020. Now, the problem is that whenever you have a big market decline like we had last Christmas, what you'll see is there will be a decline about 60 to 70 weeks after that washout low. And what seems to drive part of that is people keep an eye on the calendar. They look at the calendar and say, well, let's see, if I hold on to my stock 52 weeks and I've got more than a year in a position, mm-hmm. I can qualify for long-term capital gains rates, which lowers your tax burden on making money.
Considerably.
A lot, yeah. It's like 20% or some ridiculously low level. And that's a separate policy question, which is bound to come up in politics, because originally that 20% capital gains rate was put in place so that there would be lots more capital formation. The problem today is we got gobs of capital, and it's just sitting on the sidelines. And that's evidenced by a figure we look at called velocity of money at M2. Essentially, the money is sitting on the sidelines. Why do anything? Why be at risk when you can have a big pile of money and just sit back and print more for yourself effectively?
What happened, George, in 1929, 90 years ago, for that crash?
Well, what happened was very similar to what's going on now. It's all caused, in part at least, by a technological overlap. When you have several new industries all coming online at the same time, and the old ones haven't gone away completely, well, what happens is you get a real bubble in employment. The number of jobs unfilled in America today is probably higher than it was even in the 1920s. And so as a result of that, the times are exceptionally good and everybody is confident. The problem is, at some point, the old industry begins to go away and you settle into normal growth for the new industry. Now, in the 1920s case, that involved, on the going outside, you had the end of horse-drawn agriculture. Draft animals went away, but yeah, still had a lot of street sweepers because even up through the 20s, there were still products being delivered in major urban areas by horse-drawn teams and so forth. And that causes ripple employment in things like street sweepers, and people tend to forget that horses are messy. So you have that old industry carrying on. then you had the new industry, which was automobiles, and you had another new industry called radio, and then you had all of the other technological things that were spinning off from those core items. For example, advertising. Advertising agencies were huge in the late 1920s because they evolved to fill the needs of radio.
Mm-hmm. That's
right. In a similar way, what's going on now is we've got AI coming down the pike. We've got additional networking. We've got robotics, self-driving, autonomous vehicles. Yet at the same time, Boeing's MAX problems notwithstanding, we're still building airplanes. We're still building computers. As small and great as our smartphones are, there are still desktops. And ubiquitous computing is not here yet. So we have all of these things demanding lots of smart people to work for us. And that's why we have such high employment right now. When we start to see the rollout of the robotics, the real rollout of AI, that's when we start to see the end of some of the other technologies, and that's when the unemployment rates ought to begin to climb back up again.
Do you see a war in 2020?
No, probably not. A good friend of mine, I call him my consigliere, was down visiting Elaine and I over Thanksgiving. He's an attorney, CPA, does taxes in a Midwest state. And he looks at cycles in long-wave economics, very similar to how I look at them. He did some work that turned up a 72-year war cycle. And the countries right now that are hot on the 72-year war cycle are India-Pakistan, which is still bubbling away, and also Israel was founded in, what was it, 48?
1948, yeah.
Yep. So we've got that one coming of age in 2020. But in terms of the U.S., it looks more like 2025, 2026. We haven't had our big crash yet. And until we get the big crash, we don't get the big depression. But in the typical sequence, you'll have a blow off, then you'll have an excess correction, and people will really pull in their horns, start not spending money on anything. And part of that is due to an effect called consumer supersaturation. And what that means is everybody's already got three of everything. I wander around our place.
But they want more, George.
Oh, yeah, more. No question. I mean, I'm looking at, you know, for two people in their 70s, do we really need four 55-inch TVs and large? but I'm looking at the OLEDs, and I'm going, well, hell, OLED would be kind of cool. So, you know, it's that kind of excess consumption. When the excess consumption rings out and people say, well, you know, I'm not sure about the future, I think I'll save money. Well, then you get these piles of capital getting even bigger on the sidelines. And so government needs to find ways to get people to work. The way you get people to work is you make up government programs, which is where things like Hoover Dam, Grand Coulee, all of those massive public works projects of the 30s came from. And that's also when ideas like interstate highway systems and, you know, to really expand the federal highway system were beginning to be talked about. At the same time, Germany was building the first of the autobahns prior to World War II. And that's how depressions typically end. You give people a big enough war, everybody's going to spend. You're going to break all of those nice toys we've been collecting in our storage units. And now you've got a rebirth of an economy waiting to happen. And as my late father used to say, if you really want to have a successful country, make a war with the U.S. and wait 20 years.
That's it. That's it. George, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back in a moment. One of George's books, by the way, is called Dimensions Next Door, Hacking Space Time. And I hear rumors he's working on a time machine. We'll talk with him a little bit about that as well. And then in our second hour with George Uhr, we'll take your phone calls as we talk about trends for 2020 right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with George Uhr, who has been dabbling in a lot of things that we'll talk with him about tonight, including a time machine. But, George, let's talk about the 2020 election. I'm making a huge assumption, of course, that Donald Trump will escape unscathed in the impeachment proceedings, that the Senate will not convict him, so he'll be the Republican candidate. I don't see a formidable Democratic candidate at this point. I still don't. Do you?
Well, I think what will happen will be the existing field of Democrats, see if we use the term, they'll get Bernied. In other words, I expect at the last minute, somebody will come back into the picture. Maybe Hillary.
Maybe her, yeah.
Yeah, and if she partnered up with Mike Bloomberg, then, you know, that might be a challenging ticket. On the other hand, I'm frankly surprised every day when I see Joe Biden remaining up at the top of polls. I pinch myself and go, can't these people who vote also read? And so there are lots of questions about politics. One thing, though, I think we can almost, no pun intended, take to the bank is that the Democrats, and there are lots of them in finance, don't want to see a strong economy, because right now...
No, of course not. They want to crash.
Well, yeah, and it's too early to do that, but we could have a situation where we could have a modest pullback. In Elliott Wave terms, it would be a small wave four, and then we could have a short, violent upside to a peak, say, end of May, and then a first wave down of the big decline to come early summer, recapture some of that on the wave two bounce. But since the third wave in Elliott Wave, at least in stocks, is generally where the biggest motion takes place, then you'd be in a down cycle for the market going into the election. And that would be quite fitting for what the Democrats have in mind, which would be taking back the Senate. Although, judging by the polls, not sure that's going to happen or not. We'll have to see how it goes when the impeachment game gets played. And in the meantime, we don't know what Nancy Pelosi's game plan is.
No.
Except that there's a couple of interesting Supreme Court cases coming up in February. And one of those involves profiting from helping people illegally enter and remain in America. And that case, I think, comes up before the Supreme Court around February 25th. And so that would be the time when the Democrats might like very much to have some national distraction to keep eyes off of major court decisions.
Let's talk about some other issues, a couple projects that we talked about in the past. One is your Light Crown project. Update us on that and explain to folks what that is, George.
Well, yeah, back in 2016, I started working with light-emitting diodes, those ubiquitous things that those red lights that are power lights and so forth on lots of electronics. And they're dandy little things. Basically, they're tiny lasers. So I decided after doing a lot of research to build something called a light crown. And it's a device with four or five of these lights on either side of your head over the temple, which is where the trigeminal nerve pack comes out of your skull. And then a third array of five lights is placed over the chakra in the middle of your forehead.
Now, is this for hair loss or more than that?
Oh, much more than that. There's a lot of evidence now about hair loss, but Also, since the light seems to penetrate into the brain some distance, it seems to have some improvement evidenced in cognitive response of aging people, for example. And I think you hit, can I say it, George, your milestone comes in 2020?
Perfect. I'll take it.
And that's frankly why I got real serious about this, because, you know, there are so many different ways to fight aging. So anyway, the light crayon story made short, it works. It's not a huge effect, but it's worth doing. There also are variants using different colors of light. If I put a green 568 or so nanometer wavelength, yellowish green over my right temple, and a blue over the left temple, that seems to have an effect almost like drinking coffee without drinking coffee. And I think where this technology originally was from is probably not this planet. It's been something passed down in the form of crowns. We can go back through history and see people wearing colored headdress. Usually when people do things, it's not always just because yellow feathers and red feathers and blue feathers look neat, and they do. But when people started putting gems around their basically hat band, I sat back and looked at that and said, well, wait a minute. In modern crowns, you can't see through the gems that are mounted on a headband. But in earlier times, is it possible the back of that headband was open to control the frequency of light striking different parts of the head? And I assume you know that there's a good bit of research on how different rooms in the pyramids were used for their light healing properties as well. So this was really weird, strange stuff to be working on in 2016, 2017. But here recently, it has this whole field of low-level laser light therapy.
Oh, it's all over the place now.
Yeah, there's over seven. If you go to clinicaltrials.gov, there are over 7,000 references, I think it is, to clinical trials involving different light therapies. And some are under photobiomodulation, others are LLLLT, low-level laser light therapy, some call it LT, and it's really an interesting mix. There was a study done at MIT a couple of years ago, and the study suggested that one way to really roll the clock back on Alzheimer's was to present a person with a flashing light that was flashing at the rate of about 40 hertz. Now, I understand one of the devices that is in clinicals is basically, think of it as a light crown, but turning the lights on and off at 40 times per second. So that in order to stimulate the frontal cortex in a particular manner. And it's also being used, the technology's being tested on Parkinson's and another series of progressive diseases. I'm not sure where Lumathera is. That's the Paulsbo company that was, still is, working on mixed light therapy for treatment of age-related macular degeneration. But I believe they're still in clinical trials in Europe. The U.S. is not real fast on new technologies coming to market due to how the mechanics of our Food and Drug Administration work.
Tell us about this time machine, George.
Oh, that. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Well, part of it's your fault.
I know.
If you don't remember, George wrote a wonderful book called Talking to the Dead.
Yep.
And you know as well as I do that there's something there.
Of course.
The problem is What is it?
And how do you get to it?
Yeah. And the Italian guy, what is that, about chapter 12 or so? Remind me how that went. But he could almost summon the voices of the dead at will, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're satisfied with that. I mean, it's statistically hard to fake.
That was a great story.
Yeah. Well, I got looking at the great stories, and I said, well, George has looked at the sound in his book, and I wonder if this all fits with what I wrote up in Dimensions Next Door. Is there a sound key to all of this stuff? By the way, you notice in Peter Davenport's report tonight, he was talking, I think it was the Bethel, Alaska case, where the people were talking about a strange sound.
Yep.
I mean, again, you know, there's just this little pile of stuff that begins to suggest that the right sound at the right frequency and moving in the right direction, and I'll get into that in a sec, can begin to bend space-time a bit. So I started going through the data, and you had Bruce Gernon on. And Bruce, you'll recall, is the guy who flew out of the Bahamas December 1st of 1970.
Mm-hmm. Into a mist.
A kind of a fog that attached to his airplane as he was coming up off of Andros Island. He got off the northwest end of the island. He was planning to fly direct over to West Palm. But instead, on the way, he had to reroute because of this lenticular cloud that snuck up on him, overtook the aircraft, and then the instrument started spinning, and the cloud closed in around him in kind of a horseshoe fashion. Well, there's another book that Gernon and his co-author, Rob McGregor, wrote, and that also has additional accounts of incidents where this fog or sound fog and sound were occurring in proximity. Now, they don't get into the sound aspect of it far enough. They get into the flying the airplanes part. But when you consider the profile of the aircraft he was flying, which was a Beechcraft Bonanza, three-bladed propeller, he had a second encounter with a similar electronic or whatever it is, fog, that occurred some years later in an aircraft, a Cessna. But when I looked at the picture of the Cessna, my gosh, it was a three-bladed propeller also. So in all of Flight 19, those five TBMs that went missing.
That just disappeared, yeah.
Yeah, those were all three-blade propellers too. So we can begin to work backwards and see what was going on in terms of frequencies, because these aircraft all tend to turn over their propellers at about between 2,500 and 2,350 RPM for cruise, and that's when Gernon's event began, was when he was coming off the Beechcraft spins up about 2,600 or so, 2,650 RPM on takeoff. But when you get up to cruise climb, you dial back the constant speed prop, the engine slows down a bit to about 2,500, and off you go. Well, so you I've been collecting these profiles of sound, trying to figure out what is that frequency and how do I create it in my little home studio.
Hmm.
So, and it sounds ridiculous until you start looking at the evidence of this cloud effect elsewhere. And we could start at the Bible. Moses went up the mountain to get the commandments, but he was up there 40 days, and he went up into the cloud. And when the Jews were being led out of Egypt, there was a fire of pillar and cloud day and night. And also, there's some interesting things about how light and sound may be engaged together. When you read Exodus, there's a description in there I know Raiders of the Lost Ark, everybody knows that flick. But what most people don't appreciate, I think, fully, is that in addition to the Ark in the Holy of Holies, there was also a very special lamp. And that lamp weighed between 60 and 70 pounds, and it was made of pure gold. And it was arranged so that there were seven lights on it, three on either side, and we assume one in the middle.
And the lights, of course, were supposed to be candles, right?
No, actually, they were supposed to be the purest of oil. So in my research, purest of oil turns
so
out.
So oil lights.
Oil lights, yeah. And interesting, olive oil lights have some really neat properties. For example, they're actually pretty safe. Don't try this at home, but if you have an oil light with olive oil and you drop it on the floor, the oil won't catch fire on the floor. It's a wicking oil.
Huh.
And so, I mean, that's kind of interesting. So then, you know, it's time to hit the books and try, okay, so maybe what goes on when the cloud from which the voice of the Almighty appears is really connected to Gernon's experience. And so when you start looking in lots of religious books for clouds and people, I mean, it's all over the place, George. Magic carpets, clouds.
But how do you tie this into a time?
Because there's always a sound element to it. When the voice of the Almighty was being heard, there were usually people blowing
trumpets.
Ram's horns, correct, the trumpets. And so when the priests circled Jericho for 6 days, they didn't blow the trumpets till the seventh day. So we've got sound, we've got light. There are apparently certain times and light angles that are best. And one other thing, curiously, is smoke.
Smoke,
yeah. It's subtle, but if you've flown to the Caribbean, you ever get off the aircraft in, like, Jamaica and you can smell cooking fires?
Have I done a cruise? I don't know yet.
Yeah, take time off, George.
Work too much.
Really. Out in the Bahamas in the 70s, it was very common for there to be a good bit of smoke because people would take, you know, the local sea grape and burn that and so forth for fuel. And so you had smoke. And also there was burnt offerings going on in the Holy of Holies. So now we've got another smoke source. And then you've got burning of the finest of grains mixed with oils. And in any Catholic Mass, you've seen the officiator at the Mass swinging the censer of what? Smoke. And that's really incense.
All right, but how does all this tie into being a time traveler?
The theory that begins to emerge out of this is that the right frequency in the presence of the right kind of light and the right kind of suspended particulate will begin to open up a portal.
A time portal?
Well, it's an everything portal.
Do you know where you're traveling to and from?
There's actually a little bit of suggestion that if you are in one of these clouds, like Vernon is, and you're headed west, you will move faster than local time. He and McGregor, in their second book, report the case of an aircraft flying from Miami out to the Bahamas. And that aircraft actually took 5 hours or so, much longer than it should.
Should have taken an hour. We're going to come back and talk more about this, George, plus we'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.